These statements are met with lectures at first, but they soon become loudly voiced decrees and slammed doors. His mother stays out of the arguments as much as she can, but when pressed, she agrees with her husband, while at the same time quietly asserting that it should really be Bailey's decision. Bailey is not even certain he wants to go to Harvard. He does like the city more than Caroline, and it seems to him to be the option that holds the most mystery, the most possibility, whereas the farm holds only sheep and apples and predictability. He can already envision how it will play out every day, every season, when the apples will fall and when the sheep will need shearing and when the frost will come, always the same, year after year. He mentions something about the endless repetition to his mother, hoping it might turn into a more measured conversation about whether or not he will be allowed to leave. But she only says that she finds the cyclical nature of the farm comforting and asks if he has finished all of his chores. The invitations to tea in Cambridge now arrive addressed only to Bailey, leaving his sister off entirely. Caroline mutters something about not having time for such things anyway, and Bailey attends alone, grateful to be able to enjoy the trip without Caroline's constant talking.
"I do not particularly care whether or not you attend Harvard," his grandmother says one afternoon, though Bailey has not mentioned it. He generally attempts to avoid the subject, thinking he knows perfectly well where she stands. He adds another spoon of sugar to his tea and waits for her to elaborate.
"I believe it would offer you more opportunity," she continues, "and that is something that I would like you to have, even if your parents are not enthused about the idea. Do you know why I gave my daughter permission to marry your father?"
"No," Bailey says. It is not a topic that has ever been discussed in his presence, though Caroline once told him in secret she heard it was something of a scandal. Even almost 20 years later, his father never sets foot in his grandmother's house, nor does she ever come out to Concord.
"Because she would have run off with him regardless," she says. "That was what she wished. It would not have been my choice for her, but a child should not have their choices dictated for them. I have listened to you read books aloud to my cats. When you were 5 years old, you turned a laundry tub into a pirate ship and launched an attack against the hydrangeas in my garden. Do not try to convince me that you would choose that farm."
"I have a responsibility," Bailey says, repeating the word he has begun to hate. His grandmother makes a noise that may be a laugh or a cough or a combination of the two.
"Follow your dreams, Bailey," she says. "Be they Harvard or something else entirely, no matter what that father of yours says, or how loudly he might say it, he forgets that he was someone's dream once himself."
Bailey nods, and his grandmother sits back in her chair and complains about the neighbors for some time, not mentioning his father or his dreams again. Though before Bailey leaves, she adds,
"Do not forget what I said."
"I won't,"
he assures her. He does not tell her that he has only one dream, and it is just as improbable as a career in garden piracy. But he valiantly continues to debate with his father on a regular basis.
"Doesn't my opinion matter?"
he asks one evening before the conversation escalates to door slamming.
"No, it does not,"
his father answers.
"Maybe you should let this go, Bailey,"
his mother says quietly after his father leaves the room. Bailey begins spending a great deal of time outside of the house. School does not take up as many hours as he would like. At first, he works more, in the far rows of the orchards, choosing the farthest points from wherever his father happens to be. Then he resorts to taking long walks through fields and woods and cemeteries. He wanders past graves belonging to philosophers and poets, authors whose books he knows from his grandmother's library, and there are countless other headstones engraved with names he does not recognize, and more that have been so worn by time and wind that they are illegible, their owners long forgotten. He walks with no particular destination in mind, but the place he ends up most frequently is the very same oak tree he so often sat in with Caroline and her friends. It is more manageable now that he is taller, and he climbs to the topmost branches with ease. It is shaded enough to feel secluded, but bright enough to read when he brings books along, which soon becomes part of his routine. He reads histories and mythologies and fairy tales, wondering why it seems that only girls are ever swept away from their mundane lives on farms by knights or princes or wolves. It strikes him as unfair to not have the same fanciful opportunity himself, and he is not in the position to do any rescuing of his own. During the hours spent watching the sheep as they wander aimlessly around their fields, he even wishes that someone would come and take him away, but wishes on sheep appear to work no better than wishes on stars. He tells himself that it is not a bad life, that there is nothing wrong with being a farmer. But still, the discontent remains. Even the ground beneath his feet feels unsatisfying to his boots. So, he continues to escape to his tree. To make the tree his own, he even goes so far as to move the old wooden box in which he keeps his most valued possessions from its standard hiding spot beneath a loose floorboard under his bed to a nook in the oak tree, a substantial indentation that is not quite a hole, but secure enough to serve the purpose. The box is fairly small, with tarnished brass hinges and clasps. It is wrapped in a scrap of burlap that does a fairly good job of keeping it protected from the elements, and it sits securely enough that it has not been dislodged by even the most resourceful squirrels. Its contents include a chipped arrowhead he found in a field when he was 5, a stone with a hole straight through it that is supposedly lucky, a black feather, a shiny rock that his mother said was some sort of quartz, a coin that was his first never-spent pocket money, the brown leather collar that belonged to the family dog who died when Bailey was 9. A solitary white glove that has gone rather grey from a combination of age and being kept in a small box with rocks. And several yellowed and folded pages filled with handwritten text. After the circus departed, he wrote down every detail he could remember about it so it would not fade in his memory. The chocolate-covered popcorn, the tent full of people on raised circular platforms performing tricks with bright white fire, the magical transforming clock that sat across from the ticket booth, doing so much more than simply telling the time. While he catalogued each element of the circus in shaky handwriting, he could not manage to record his encounter with the red-haired girl. He never told anyone about her. He looked for her at the circus during his 2 subsequent visits during proper nighttime hours, but he had not been able to find her. Then the circus was gone, vanished as suddenly as it had appeared, like a fleeting dream, and it has not returned. The only proof he has now that the girl even existed and was not a figment of his imagination is the glove. But he doesn't open the box anymore. It sits firmly closed in the tree. He thinks maybe he should throw it away, but he cannot bring himself to do it. Perhaps he will leave it in the tree and let the bark grow over it, sealing it inside. It is a grey Saturday morning, and Bailey is up earlier than the rest of the family, which is not unusual. He performs his chores as quickly as possible, packs an apple in his bag along with his book, and heads off to his tree. Halfway there, he thinks perhaps he should have worn his scarf, but the day is bound to get warmer as it goes along. Concentrating on that comforting fact, he climbs up past the bottom branches he was relegated to years ago, past the branches claimed by his sister and her friends. This is Millie's branch, he thinks as his foot touches it. A feeling of satisfaction comes when he climbs above Caroline's branch, even after all this time. Surrounded by leaves that rustle in the breeze, Bailey settles into his favorite spot, his boots resting close to his almost forgotten box of treasures. When he finally looks up from his book, Bailey is so shocked by the sight of the black and white striped tents in the field that he nearly falls out of the tree. Part 2. Illumination. There is so much that glows in the circus, from flames to lanterns to stars. I have heard the expression, trick of the light, applied to sights within Le Cirque des Rêves, so frequently that I sometimes suspect the entirety of the circus is itself a complex illusion of illumination. Friedrich Thiessen, 1894. Opening Night 1, Inception. London, October 13 and 14, 1886. Opening day, or opening night rather, is spectacular. Every last detail is planned, and a massive crowd gathers outside the gates long before sundown. When they are finally allowed to enter, they do so wide-eyed, and as they move from tent to tent, their eyes only get wider. Every element of the circus blends together in a wonderful coalescence. Acts that have been training in separate countries on separate continents now perform in adjacent tents, each part melding seamlessly into a whole. Each costume, each gesture, each sign on each tent is more perfect than the last. The air itself is ideal, clear and crisp and cool, permeated with scents and sounds that entice and enchant one patron after another. At midnight, the bonfire is ceremoniously lit, having spent the earlier part of the evening standing empty, appearing to be a simple sculpture of twisted iron. 12 of the fire performers quietly enter the courtyard with small platforms that they set up along the perimeter, like numbers on a clock. Precisely 1 minute before the hour, they each ascend their respective platforms and pull from their backs shimmering black bows and arrows. At 30 seconds before midnight, they light the tips of their arrows with small dancing yellow flames. Those in the crowd who had not noticed them previously now watch in wonder. At 10 seconds before the hour, they raise their bows and aim the flaming arrows at the waiting well of curling iron. As the clock begins to chime near the gates, the first archer lets his arrow fly, soaring over the crowd and hitting its mark in a shower of sparks. The bonfire ignites in an eruption of yellow flame. Then the second chime follows. The second archer sends his arrow into the yellow flames, and they become a clear sky blue. A third chime, with a third arrow, and the flames are a warm, bright pink. Flames the color of a ripe pumpkin follow the fourth arrow. A fifth, and the flames are scarlet red. A sixth brings a deeper, sparkling crimson. 7, and the fire is soaked in a color like an incandescent wine. 8, and the flames are shimmering violet. 9, and violet shifts to indigo. A tenth chime, a tenth arrow, and the bonfire turns deepest midnight blue. On the penultimate chime, the dancing flames change from blue to black, and for that moment, it is difficult to discern the fire from its cauldron. And on the final strike, the dark flames are replaced with a blinding white, a shower of sparks falling like snowflakes around it. Huge curls of dense white smoke swirl up into the night sky. The reaction from the crowd is uproarious. The spectators who had been considering taking their leave decide to stay just a bit longer and comment enthusiastically about the lighting of the fire. Those who do not witness it themselves hardly believe the stories told minutes or hours later. People roam from tent to tent, wandering down paths that loop over each other, never seeming to end. Some enter each tent they pass, while others are more selective, choosing tents to enter after careful consideration of signs. Some find a particular tent so fascinating that they are unable to exit it, opting instead to stay there the duration of their visit. Patrons make suggestions to other patrons they pass on the concourses, pointing out remarkable tents they have visited already. Their advice is always taken with pleasure, though often the advisees are distracted by other tents before they locate the recommended ones. It is difficult to usher the remaining patrons out as the dawn creeps up, and they are only consoled by assurances that they may return when the sun sets again. All told, opening night is an undeniable success. There is only one minor mishap of sorts, one unexpected occurrence. It passes unnoticed by any of the patrons, and many of the performers are not aware of it until after the fact. Just before sunset, while the last-minute preparations are being made, costumes adjusted, caramel melted, the wife of the wildcat tamer unexpectedly goes into labor. She is, when not in a delicate state, her husband's assistant. Their act has been subtly modified for her absence, but the cats themselves seem agitated. She is expecting twins, though they are not due for a few more weeks. People joke afterwards that perhaps they did not want to miss opening night. A doctor is brought to the circus before it opens to the public and escorted discreetly backstage for the delivery, an easier feat to accomplish than moving her to a hospital. 6 minutes before midnight, Winston Aiden Murray is born. 7 minutes after midnight, his sister Penelope Aislinn Murray follows. When the news is relayed to Chandresh Christophe Lefebvre, he is mildly disappointed that the twins are not identical. He had thought up various roles in the circus for identical twins to perform once the children were old enough. Fraternal twins, on the other hand, lacked the amount of theatricality he had expected, but he has Marco arrange the delivery of two enormous bouquets of red roses anyway. They are tiny things, each with a rather surprising amount of bright red hair. They barely cry, staying awake and alert, with matching pairs of wide blue eyes. They are wrapped in spare bits of silk and satin, white for her and black for him. A steady stream of circus performers comes to see them in between acts, taking turns holding them and inevitably remarking on their exquisite timing. They will fit right in, everyone says, save for their hair. Someone suggests hats until they are old enough for hair dye. Someone else remarks that it would be a travesty to dye over such a color, a shocking red, much brighter than their mother's auburn. It is an auspicious color, Tsukiko comments, but she refuses to elaborate on her meaning. She kisses each twin on the forehead and later makes strings of folded paper cranes to hang above their cradle. Close to dawn, when the circus is emptying, they are taken for a walk around the tents and into the courtyard. The purpose is ostensibly to lull them to sleep, but they stay awake, watching the lights and the costumes and the stripes on the tents around them, strangely alert for being only a few hours old. Not until the sun has risen do they finally close their eyes. Side by side, in the black wrought iron cradle, lined with striped blankets that already awaits them, despite their early arrival. It was delivered as a gift a few weeks earlier, though it had no card or note. The Murrays assumed it was a gift from Chandresh, though when they thanked him for it, he claimed he had no idea what they were talking about. The twins quite like it, regardless of its dubious origins. No one recalls afterward exactly who it was that dubbed them Poppet and Widget. As with the cradle, no one takes credit for it. But the nicknames stick, as nicknames do. Opening Night 2, Sparks. London, October 13 and 14, 1886. Marco spends the first several hours of opening night taking surreptitious glances at his watch, waiting impatiently for the hands to reach midnight. The unexpected early arrival of the Murray twins has complicated his schedule already, but if the lighting of the bonfire proceeds as planned, that should be enough. It is the best solution he can come up with, knowing that in a few weeks the circus will be hundreds of miles away, leaving him alone in London. And while Isabel may prove helpful, he needs a stronger tie. Ever since he discovered the venue for the challenge, he has been slowly taking on more responsibility for the circus, doing all that Chandresh asked of him, and more, to the point where he was given free rein with everything, from approving the design of the gates to ordering the canvas for the tents. It worries him, the scope of the binding. He has never attempted anything on this scale, but there seems no good reason not to start off the game as strongly as possible. The bonfire will provide him with a connection to the circus, even though he is not entirely certain how well it will work. And with so many people involved, it seems sensible to add an element of safety to the venue. It has taken months of preparation. Chandrish was more than willing to let him organize the lighting, having already deemed him invaluable to the circus planning, with only mild coercion. A wave of a hand, and the details were all up to him. And most important, Chandrish agreed to let it be a secret. The lighting itself took on the air of a midnight dinner, with no questions permitted as to the ingredients or menu. No answers provided as to what the arrows are tipped with to create such an astounding effect, how the flames are made to shift from one vibrant hue to another. Those who did inquire during preparations and rehearsals were told that to reveal the methods would ruin the effect. Though, of course, Marco has been unable to rehearse the most important part. It is easy enough for him to slip away from Chandrish in the crowded courtyard just before midnight. He makes his way toward the twisted iron, moving as close as he can to the empty cauldron. He takes a large leather-bound notebook from his coat, a perfect copy of one that has been safely locked in his office. No one in the milling crowd notices as he tosses it into the bottom of the cauldron. It lands with a thud that is muffled by the ambient noise. The cover flips open, exposing the elaborate ink tree to the star-speckled night sky. He stays close to the edge of the twisted metal while the archers take their places. His attention remains focused on the flames, despite the press of patrons around him, as the fire is amplified through a rainbow of hues. When the last arrow lands, he closes his eyes. The white flames burn red through his eyelids. Celia expected to feel like a poor imitation of her father during her first performances, but to her relief, the experience is vastly different from the one she watched so many times in theater after theater. The space is small and intimate. The audiences are modest enough that they remain individual people rather than blending into an anonymous crowd. She finds she is able to make each performance unique, letting the response of the audience inform what she chooses to do next. While she enjoys it more than she thought she would, she is grateful that she has stretches of time to herself in between. As it nears midnight, she decides to see if she can find a place to discreetly watch the lighting of the bonfire. But as she makes her way through the area that is already being referred to as backstage, despite the lack of stage, she is quickly swept up in the somewhat ordered chaos surrounding the impending birth of the Murray twins. Several of the performers and staff have gathered, waiting anxiously. The doctor who has been brought in seems to find the entire situation strange. The contortionist comes and goes. Aidan Murray paces like one of his cats. Celia endeavors to be as helpful as she can, which consists mainly of fetching cups of tea and finding new and creative ways to assure people that everything will be fine. It reminds her so much of consoling her old spiritualist clients that she is surprised when she is thanked by name. The soft cry that sounds minutes before midnight comes as a relief, met by sighs and cheers. And then, something else immediately follows. Celia feels it before she hears the applause echoing from the courtyard, the shift that suddenly spreads through the circus like a wave. It courses through her body, sending an involuntary shiver down her spine, almost knocking her off her feet. "Are you all right?" a voice behind her says, and she turns to find Tsukiko laying a warm hand on her arm to steady her. The two-knowing gleam that Celia is beginning to find familiar shines in the contortionist's smiling eyes. "I'm fine, thank you," Celia says, struggling to catch her breath. "You are a sensitive person," Tsukiko says. "It is not unusual for sensitive people to be affected by such events." Another cry echoes from the adjoining chamber, joining the first in a gentle chorus. "They have remarkable timing," Tsukiko says, turning her attention to the newborn twins. Celia can only nod. It is a shame you missed the writing, Tsukiko continues. It was remarkable as well. While the Murray twins' cries subside, Celia tries to shake the feeling that remains tingling over her skin. She is still unsure who her opponent is, but whatever move has just been made, it has rattled her. She feels the entirety of the circus radiating around her, as though a net has been thrown over it, trapping everything within the iron fence, fluttering like a butterfly. She wonders how she is supposed to retaliate. Opening Night 3. Smoke and Mirrors. London, October 13 and 14, 1886. Chandresh Christophe Lefebvre enters not a single tent on opening night. Instead, he wanders through pathways and concourses and walks in loops around the courtyard with Marco in tow, who is taking notes whenever Chandresh finds something to comment upon. Chandresh watches the crowd, discerning how people decide which tents to enter. He identifies signage that needs to be adjusted or elevated to be easier to read, doors that are not visible enough, and others that are too predominant, drawing too little attention or too much of a crowd. But these are minute details, really. Extra oil for inaudible squeaking. It could not be better. The people are delighted. The line for tickets snakes around the outside of the fence. The entire circus glistens with excitement. A few minutes before midnight, Chandresh positions himself by the edge of the courtyard for the lighting of the bonfire. He chooses a spot where he can view both the bonfire and a good portion of the crowd.
"Everything is ready for the lighting, correct?"
he asks. No one answers him. He turns to his left and his right, finding only giddy patrons streaming past.
"Marco?"
he says, but Marco is nowhere to be found. One of the Burgess sisters spots Chandresh and approaches him, carefully navigating her way through the crowded courtyard.
"Hello, Chandresh," she says when she reaches him. "Is something wrong?" "I seem to have misplaced Marco," he says. "Strange, but nothing to worry about, Lainey dear."
"Tara," she corrects.
"You look alike,"
Chandresh says, puffing on his cigar.
"It's confusing. You should stay together as a set to avoid such faux pas." "Really, Chandresh, we're not even twins." "Which of you is older, then?"
"That's a secret," Tara says, smiling. "May we declare the evening a success yet?"
"So far, it is satisfactory, but the night is relatively young, my dear. How is Mrs. Murray?"
"She's doing fine, I believe, though it's been an hour or so since I heard any news. It will make for a memorable birthday for the twins, I should think."
"They might be useful if they're as indistinguishable as you and your sister. We could put them in matching costumes."
Tara laughs.
"You might wait until they can walk, at least."
Around the unlit cauldron that will hold the bonfire, 12 archers are taking their positions. Tara and Chandresh halt their conversation to watch. Tara observes the archers while Chandresh watches the crowd as their attention is drawn to the display. They turn from crowd to audience, as though choreographed along with the archers, everything proceeding precisely as planned. The archers let their arrows fly one by one, sending the flames through a rainbow of conflagration. The entire circus is doused in color as the clock tolls, 12 deep chimes reverberating through the circus. On the 12th knell, the bonfire blazes, white and hot. Everything in the courtyard shudders for a moment, scarves fluttering despite the lack of any breeze, the fabric of the tents quivering. The audience bursts into applause. Tara claps along, while beside her, Chandresh stumbles, dropping his cigar to the ground.
"Chandresh, are you all right?"
Tara asks.
"I feel rather dizzy," he says.
Tara takes Chandresh by the arm to steady him, pulling him closer to the side of the nearest tent, out of the way of the crowd that has started moving again, spilling out in all directions.
"Did you feel that?"
he asks her. His legs are shaking, and Tara struggles to support him as they are jostled by passers-by.
"Feel what?"
she asks, but Chandresh does not reply, still clearly unsteady.
"Why did no one think to put benches in the courtyard?"
Tara mutters to herself.
"Is there a problem, Miss Burgess?"
a voice asks behind her. She turns to find Marco hovering behind her, notebook in hand and looking quite concerned.
"Oh, Marco, there you are,"
Tara says.
"Something is wrong with Chandresh."
They are beginning to attract stares from the crowd. Marco takes Chandresh's arm and pulls him into a quieter corner, standing with his back to the courtyard to provide a modicum of privacy.
"Has he been like this long?"
Marco asks Tara as he steadies Chandresh.
"No, it came on quite suddenly," she replies. "I worry he might faint."
"I'm sure it's nothing," Marco tells her.
"The heat, perhaps. I can handle this, Miss Burgess. It's nothing to concern yourself with."
Tara furrows her brow, reluctant to leave.
"It's nothing," Marco repeats emphatically.
Chandresh looks at the ground as though he has lost something, not seeming to register the conversation at all.
"If you insist," Tara relents.
"He's in perfectly good hands, Miss Burgess," Marco says,
and then he turns before she can say another word, and he and Chandresh walk off into the crowd.
"There you are,"
Lainey says, appearing at her sister's shoulder.
"I've been looking everywhere for you. Did you see the lighting? Wasn't it spectacular?"
"Indeed," Tara says, still scanning the crowd.
"Whatever is the matter?"
Lainey asks.
"Did something happen?" "How much do you know about Chandresh's assistant?"
Tara asks in response.
"Marco? Not very much,"
Lainey says.
"He's worked for Chandresh for a few years, specializes in accounting. Before that, he was a scholar of some sort, I believe. I'm not entirely sure what he studied, or where, for that matter. He's not particularly talkative. Why do you ask? Seeking another dark and handsome conquest?"
Tara laughs, despite her distraction.
"No, nothing like that. Only curiosity."
She takes her sister by the arm.
"Let us go and seek out other mysteries to explore for the moment."
Arm in arm, they navigate the crowd, circling around the glowing bonfire that many patrons are still gazing at, mesmerized by the dancing white flames. The Hanged Man. In this tent, suspended high above you, there are people. Acrobats, trapeze artists, aerialists, illuminated by dozens of round, glowing lamps hanging from the top of the tent, like planets or stars. There are no nets. You watch the performers from this precarious vantage point, directly below the performers, with nothing in between. There are girls in feathered costumes who spin at various heights, suspended by ribbons that they can manipulate. Marionettes that control their own strings. Normal chairs with legs and backs act as trapezes. Round spheres that resemble bird cages rise and descend, while one or more aerialists move from within the sphere to without, standing on the top or hanging from the bars on the bottom. In the center of the tent, there is a man in a tuxedo, suspended by one leg that is tied with a silver cord, hands clasped behind his back. He begins to move, extremely slowly. His arms reach out from his sides, first one and then the other, until they hang below his head. He starts to spin, faster and faster, until he is only a blur at the end of a rope. He stops suddenly, and he falls. The audience dives out of the way below him, clearing a space of bare, hard ground below. You cannot bear to watch. You cannot look away. Then he stops at eye level with the crowd, suspended by the silver rope that now seems endlessly long, top hat undisturbed on his head, arms calmly by his sides. As the crowd regains its composure, he lifts a gloved hand and removes his hat. bending at the waist, he takes a dramatic, inverted bow. Oneiromancy. Concord, Massachusetts, October 1902. Bailey spends the entire day willing the sun to set, but it defies him and keeps its usual pace across the sky, a pace that Bailey has never really thought about before, but today finds excruciatingly slow. He almost wishes it were a school day so he would have something to help pass the hours. He wonders if he should take a nap, but he is far too excited about the sudden appearance of the circus to possibly sleep. Dinner passes the same way it has for months, stretches of silence broken by his mother's attempts at polite conversation and Caroline's occasional sighs. His mother mentions the circus, or, more specifically, the influx of people it will bring. Bailey expects the silence to fall again, but instead Caroline turns to him.
"Didn't we dare you to sneak into the circus last time it was here, Bailey?"
Her tone is curious and light, as though she truly does not remember whether or not such a thing occurred.
"What? During the day?"
his mother asks. Caroline nods vaguely.
"Yes,"
Bailey says quietly, willing the uncomfortable silence to return.
"Bailey,"
his mother says, managing to turn his name into a disappointment-laced admonishment. Bailey is not certain how it is his fault being the daree and not the darer, but Caroline responds before he can protest.
"Oh, he didn't do it,"
she says, as though she now recalls the incident clearly. Bailey only shrugs.
"Well, I would hope not,"
his mother says. The silence resumes, and Bailey stares out the window, wondering what exactly constitutes nightfall. He thinks perhaps it would be best to get to the gates as soon as it could even remotely be considered dusk, and wait if necessary. His feet feel itchy beneath the table, and he wonders how soon he will be able to escape. It takes ages to clear the table, an eternity to help his mother with the dishes. Caroline disappears to her room, and his father pulls out the newspaper.
"Where are you going?"
his mother asks as he puts on his scarf.
"I'm going to the circus," Bailey says. "Don't be too late," she says. "You have work to do."
"I won't," Bailey says, relieved that she has neglected to specify a time, leaving "too late" up to interpretation.
"Take your sister," she adds.
Only because there is no way to leave the house without his mother watching to see whether or not he stops at Caroline's room, Bailey knocks at the half-closed door.
"Go away,"
his sister says.
"I'm going to the circus, if you would care to join me,"
Bailey says, his voice dull. He already knows what her answer will be.
"No,"
she says, as predictable as the dinner-time silence.
"How childish,"
she adds, shooting him a disdainful glare. Bailey leaves without another word, letting the wind slam the front door behind him. The sun is just beginning to set, and there are more people out than usual at this time of day, all walking in the same direction. As he walks, his excitement begins to wane. Perhaps it is childish. Perhaps it will not be the same. When he reaches the field, there is already a crowd gathered, and he is relieved that there are plenty of patrons his own age or much older, and only a few have children with them. A pair of girls around his age giggles as he passes them, trying to catch his eye. He cannot tell if it is meant to be flattering or not. Bailey finds a spot to stand within the crowd. He waits, watching the closed iron gates, wondering if the circus will be different than he remembers. And he wonders, in the back of his mind, if the red-haired girl in white is somewhere inside. The low orange rays from the sun make everything, including the circus, look as though it is aflame before the light disappears completely. It is quicker than Bailey expected, the moment that shifts from fire to twilight, and then the circus lights begin flickering on, all over the tents. The crowd oohs and ahs appropriately, but a few in the front gasp in surprise when the massive sign above the gates begins to sputter and spark. Bailey can't help but smile when it is fully lit, shining like a beacon. Le Cirque des Rêves. While the day of waiting was tediously slow, the line to enter the circus moves remarkably fast, and soon Bailey is standing at the ticket booth, purchasing a single admission. The winding path, speckled with stars, seems endless as he feels his way through the dark turns, anxiously anticipating the brightness at the end. The first thing he thinks when he reaches the illuminated courtyard is that it smells the same, of smoke and caramel and something else that he cannot place. He is not sure where to start. There are so many tents, so many choices. He thinks perhaps he should walk around a bit first before deciding which tents to enter. He thinks also that by simply wandering the circus he might improve his chances of happening upon the red-haired girl, though he refuses to admit to himself that he is looking for her. Silly to look for a girl he only met once under extremely strange circumstances several years ago. There's no reason to believe that she'd even remember him or recognize him, and he is not entirely sure he would recognize her either for that matter. He decides to walk into the circus, through the courtyard with the bonfire and out the other side, and then attempt to work his way back. It is as good a plan as any, and the crowd might not be as thick on the far side. But first, he thinks, he should get a mulled cider. It does not take him long to find the proper vendor in the courtyard. He pays for his cup, the steaming concoction contained in black and white marble swirls, and wonders for a moment, before his first sip, if it won't taste as good as he remembers. He has recalled that taste countless times in his head, and despite the wealth of apples in the area, no cider with or without spices has ever tasted as good. He hesitates before taking the tiniest of sips. It tastes even better than he remembers. He picks a path to take, and along it, between the entrances to the surrounding tents, there is a small group gathered around a raised platform. A woman stands on the platform in a very fitted costume covered in black and silver swirls. She is twisting and bending in such a way that it seems both horrible and elegant. Bailey stops to join the spectators, even though it is almost painful to watch. The contortionist lifts a small silver metal hoop from the ground, brandishing it with a few simple but impressive movements. She passes it to a man in the front of the crowd in order to establish that it is solid. When he hands it back to her, she passes her entire body through it, extending her limbs in fluid, dance-like motions. After discarding the hoop, she places a small box in the center of the platform. The box looks no more than a foot wide or high, though in reality it is slightly larger than that. While the act of a fully grown, if below average size woman, condensing herself into such a confined space would be impressive, regardless of the details of the box, it is made even more impressive in this case by the fact that this box is made of glass, completely transparent. The edges are metal, oxidized to a blackish tinge, but the side panels and the lid are clear glass, so she is visible the entire time as she bends and twists and folds herself into the tiny space. She does it slowly, making each minute movement part of the show, until her body and head are completely within the box, and only her hand remains without, sticking out the top. The view from Bailey's perspective looks impossible. A bit of leg here, the curve of a shoulder there, part of her other arm underneath a foot. Only one hand remains. It waves cheerfully before pulling the lid closed. It latches automatically, and the box is undeniably closed, with the contortionist clearly visible inside. And then the glass box with the woman trapped inside slowly fills with white smoke. It curls through the tiny cracks and spaces not occupied by limbs or torso, and seeps between her fingers as they press against the glass. The smoke thickens, obscuring the contortionist completely. There is only white smoke visible inside the box, and it continues to ripple and undulate against the glass. Suddenly, with a popping noise, the box breaks. The glass panels fall to the sides, and the lid collapses downward. Curls of smoke rise into the night air. The box, or rather the small pile of glass upon the platform that had once been a box, is empty. The contortionist is gone. The crowd waits for several moments, but nothing happens. The last wisps of smoke dissipate. The crowd begins to disperse. Bailey takes a closer look as he walks by, wondering if the contortionist is somehow concealed in the platform. But it is solid wood and open underneath. She has vanished completely, despite the plain evidence that there was nowhere for her to go. Bailey continues down the winding path. He finishes his cider and finds a bin to discard his cup, though as soon as he places it within the shadowed container, it seems to vanish. He walks on, reading signs, trying to decide which tent to enter. Some are large and decorated with flourishes and long descriptions of their contents. But the one that catches his eye is smaller, as is the tent on which it hangs, looping white letters on a black background. Feats of Illustrious Illusion. The entrance is open, and a line of patrons files into the illusionist's tent. Bailey joins them. Inside it is lit by a line of black iron sconces along the rounded wall and contains nothing but a ring of plain wooden chairs. There are only about 20 of them, in two staggered rows, so that the view from each seat is comparable. Bailey chooses a seat in the inside row, across from the entrance. The rest of the seats fill quickly, save for two, the one to his immediate left and another across the circle. Bailey notices two things at once. First, that he can no longer see where the entrance had been. The space where the audience had entered now appears to be solid wall, seamlessly blending with the rest of the tent. Second, there is now a dark-haired woman in a black coat sitting to his left. He is certain that she was not there before the door disappeared. Then his attention is removed from both these events, as the empty chair across the circle bursts into flame. The panic is instant. Those occupying the chairs closest to the flaming chair abandon their seats and rush for the door, only to find that there is no longer a door to be found, only a solid wall. The flames grow steadily higher, staying close to the chair, licking around the wood, though it does not appear to be burning. Bailey looks again at the woman to his left, and she winks at him, before standing and walking to the center of the circle. Amidst the panic, she calmly unbuttons her coat and removes it, tossing it with a delicate gesture toward the burning chair. What had been a heavy wool coat becomes a long piece of black silk that ripples like water over the chair. The flames vanish. Only a few lingering wisps of smoke remain, along with a sharp smell of charred wood that is slowly changing to the comforting scent of a fireplace, tinged with something like cinnamon or clove. The woman, standing in the center of the circle of chairs, pulls back the black silk with a flourish, revealing a still intact chair on which now perch several snow-white doves. Another flourish, and the black silk folds and curves in on itself, becoming a black top hat. The woman places it on her head, topping off an ensemble that looks like a ball gown fashioned out of the night sky. Black silk dotted with sparkling white crystals. She acknowledges her audience with a subtle bow. The illusionist has made her entrance. A few people, including Bailey, manage to applaud, while those who had abandoned their seats return to them, looking both disturbed and curious. The performance is continuous. The displays Bailey has difficulty thinking of as tricks meld one into the other. The doves vanish frequently, only to reappear on hats or under chairs. There is also a black raven, far too large to have been cleverly concealed. It is only after the performance has gone on for some time that Bailey slowly realizes that because of the circle of chairs, the shape and closeness of the space, there is no room for mirrors or tricks of the light. Everything is immediate and palpable. She even transforms one audience member's pocket watch from metal to sand and back again. At one point, all the chairs float some distance off the ground, and while the movement is steady and secure, Bailey's toes barely graze the floor, and he clutches the sides of his chair nervously. At the end of the act, the illusionist takes a bow with a pivoting turn, acknowledging the entire circle as the audience applauds. As she completes the rotation, she is no longer there. Only a few sparkling shimmers remain, echoes of the crystals in her gown. The door reappears in the side of the tent, and the small audience makes their way out. Bailey lags behind, glancing back as he leaves at the spot where the illusionist had been. Outside, though it was not there before, is another raised platform, much like the one the contortionist stood on. But the figure on this platform does not move. Bailey almost thinks it is a statue, dressed in a white gown edged in matching fur that cascades beyond the platform to the ground. Her hair and skin, even her eyelashes, are an icy white. But she moves. Very, very slowly. So slowly that Bailey cannot pinpoint exact motions, only slight changes. Soft flakes of iridescent snow float to the ground, falling from her like leaves from a tree. Bailey walks around, looking at her from every angle. Her eyes follow him, though the snow-flecked lashes do not blink. There is a small silver plaque on the platform, partially obscured by the cascading gown. It reads, "In Memoriam," but it does not specify who it is for. Rules of the Game, 1887 to 1889. There are fewer circus dinners now that the circus itself is up and running properly, gaining its self-sufficiency, as Chandresh phrased it at one dinner not long after opening night. The original conspirators still gather for dinner occasionally, particularly when the circus is performing nearby, but this has become more and more infrequent. Mr. A.H. does not appear, despite his standing invitation. And as these meetings were the only opportunity Marco was given to see his instructor, the continued absence frustrates him. After a year without a sign, without any word or a single glimpse of the grey top hat, Marco decides to call on him. He does not know his instructor's current residence. He assumes, rightly, that it is likely a temporary place, and by the time he tracked down the proper location, his instructor would have moved to a new, equally temporary residence. Instead, Marco carves a series of symbols into the frost on the window of his flat that faces out to the street, using the columns of the museum behind as a guide. Most of the symbols are indistinguishable unless the light hits them at precise angles, but they are collectively set into the shape of a large A. The next day, there is a knock at the door. As always, the man in the grey suit refuses to enter the flat. He only stands in the hall and fixes Marco with a cool grey stare.
"What is it that you want?" he asks.
"I would like to know if I am doing well," Marco says. His instructor looks at him for a moment, his expression as inscrutable as ever.
"Your work has been sufficient," he says.
"Is this how the challenge is going to proceed?" Marco asks. "Each of us manipulating the circus, how long will it go on?"
"You have been given a venue to work within," his instructor says. "You present your skills to the best of your ability, and your opponent does the same. You do not interfere with each other's work. It shall continue in this manner until there is a victor. It is not that complex."
"I'm not certain I understand the rules," Marco says.
"You don't need to understand the rules. You need to follow them. As I said, your work has been sufficient."
He starts to leave, but then hesitates.
"Do not do that again," he says,
pointing over Marco's shoulder at the frost-covered window. Then he turns and walks away. The symbols on the window melt into meaningless streaks. It is the middle of the day, and the circus sleeps quietly, but Celia Bowen stands in front of the carousel, watching as black and white and silver creatures file past, suspended on coordinating ribbons, riderless.
"I don't like this thing," a voice behind her says.
Hector Bowen is no more than an apparition in the dimly lit tent. His dark suit vanishes into the shadows. The shifting light catches and releases the brightness of his shirt, the gray of his hair, illuminating the disapproving glare on his face as he watches the carousel over his daughter's shoulder. "Why ever not?" Celia responds without turning. "It's extremely popular, and it was a great deal of work. That should count for something, Papa." His derisive scoff is only an echo of what it once was, and Celia is relieved that he cannot see her smile at the softness of the sound.
"You would not be so reckless, were I not..."
His voice trails off with a wave of a transparent hand next to her arm.
"Don't be cross with me about that," Celia says. "You did it to yourself. It's not my fault. You cannot undo it, and I'm hardly being reckless." "How much did you tell this architect of yours?" her father asks.
"I told him as much as I thought he needed to know," Celia says as he drifts past her, moving to inspect the carousel. "He's fond of pushing boundaries, and I offered to help him push them further. Is Mr. Barris my opponent? That would be quite devious of him, building me a carousel to avoid suspicion."
"He is not your opponent," Hector says with a dismissive gesture, the lace cuff of his shirt fluttering like a moth. "Though such a thing could very well be considered cheating."
"How is utilizing an engineer to execute an idea not working within the venue, Papa?"
"I discussed it with him. He handled the design and construction, and I embellished it. Would you like to ride it? It goes quite a bit farther than around and around." "Obviously," Hector says, looking down at the darkened tunnel that the line of creatures disappears into. "I still don't like it."
Celia sighs, walking to the edge of the carousel to pet the head of an oversized raven as it passes by. "There are already countless elements in this circus that are collaborative," she says. "Why can I not use that to my advantage? You keep insisting that I have to do more than just my performances, but I need to create opportunities in order to manage that. Mr. Barris is quite helpful in that capacity."
"Working with others will only drag you down. These people are not your friends. They are inconsequential, and one of them is your opponent. Don't forget that."
"You know who it is, don't you?" Celia asks.
"I have my suspicions."
"But you won't tell me what those are?"
"The identity of your opponent does not matter."
"It matters to me." Hector frowns, watching as she absently toys with the ring on her right hand.
"It shouldn't," he says.
"But my opponent knows who I am, yes?"
"Indeed, unless your opponent happens to be profoundly stupid, and it is unlike Alexander to choose a profoundly stupid student. But it doesn't matter. It is better for you to do your own work without influence from your opponent and without any of this collaborating, as you call it."
He waves an arm at the carousel, and the ribbons shudder, as though the softest of breezes had wandered into the tent.
"How is it better?" Celia asks. "How is anything better than anything else here? How is one tent comparable to another? How can any of this possibly be judged?" "That is not your concern."
"How can I excel at a game when you refuse to tell me the rules?" The suspended creatures turn their heads in the direction of the ghost in their midst. Griffins and foxes and wyverns stare at him with glossy black eyes.
"Stop that!"
Hector snaps at his daughter. The creatures return to their forward-facing gazes, but one of the wolves growls as it settles back into its frozen state.
"You are not taking this as seriously as you should."
"It's a circus," Celia says. "It's difficult to take it seriously."
"The circus is only a venue."
"Then this is not a game or a challenge. It's an exhibition."
It's more than that.
How?
Celia demands, but her father only shakes his head.
I have told you all the rules you need to know. You push the bounds of what your skills can do, using this circus as a show place.